Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another one of these blog things where I talk exclusively to Patreon about something that I thought Patreon should hear about. I don't do tons of these, but after glam rock, I have quite a few thoughts on the way that glam rock shook out. For one thing, it was kind of about a bigger subject, like the concept of governments and voting and that sort of thing. But there's also some storytelling considerations that went into it. The whole thing sounded cool when I pitched it. In fact, the people who were playing were all excited when I set it up for them, because I was like, yeah, you know, you're like in outer space on an asteroid, and it's all rock and roll themed, and nobody's allowed to wear pants because pants have been made illegal due to economic shortages, and you have to grow your hair out because occasionally they harvest your hair to make rope. And so I'd kind of like taken that sort of like 80s era sci-fi rock opera thing, and then tried to rationalize it and create a setting that had a sort of a rational, like, this is why it's like this, this is why people are all in, like, unitards or whatever. And as I was rationalizing it, just got into, like, well, here's their government structure, and so here's their issue, and they have these people, the Silent Singers, that collect the tithe, and the tithing box keeps getting bigger and bigger, because in ye olden times, before they had standardizations, they would tax the public, and they would often tax them according to some specific standard they set up. So they would say, like, oh, you have to pay us a certain amount of grain, you have to fill this box with grain, and then because they would specify, like, one box, what the government would then do is, over time, the boxes would get bigger and bigger, and people would have to put in more and more grain until they got mad. And so that was actually kind of where that came from, was like ye olden taxing, I thought would be interesting, except it would be space minerals, and so on. And the problem with it was, first of all, I didn't really give enough background to the players for them to figure out what their character should be like. And the second thing was, it was too big of a concept, really, to work too well in the first place. It had a lot, like, the conflict had a lot to do with what certain people felt and what was right for the broad public of this setting and everything. And because role-playing is, by its nature, like second-person storytelling, it's always like, you go here and you do this and this happens to you, you don't get a lot of insight into what other people are thinking. So I had this character, Padre Rockero, who was, he's a little bit crazy, and he kind of comes across as just a little bit crazy, but he's kind of saying the right things. And in my head, I sort of knew why Padre behaved the way that he did. The voice that he heard in his hair was actually his father's voice, because his father was sort of an abusive guy. He was previously one of the big wigs in the colony. He was a band member, and he had raised his son to be a band member, and he'd been really hard on him. And it was very much like, you do things my way, or we're not going to do things at all, and that type of thing. And so that's what Padre was raised on. And he was just a little nuts and did not understand other people. And so he was surrounded by his band, and they none of them really talked to him. None of them really interjected with anything, because they learned that he had that mentality of, like, well, we're going to do things my way, or we're not going to do things at all. But he had a lot of charisma, so they kind of just, like, trusted him to do whatever he wanted. And they didn't like to talk back, because if they said something he didn't like, you know, they were out of the band, and they didn't get second chances or anything like that. So it was all just like, everybody agrees, the band may as well have not existed. And that was kind of the joke. And I think that's important when you're writing a megalomaniac, because that's actually a flaw that you see consistently in a lot of them. From, you know, it doesn't really matter who you look at. And this drives me crazy. I see online debates. You see people on the internet who are all like, well, communism had famines because it's communism. And that's such a shallow interpretation. The reason why communism had famines was because they're autocracies. Like, the government is, there's no checks or balances whatsoever. So usually you just have one person who's in charge of everything, you know. So in the example of Stalin, what Stalin did was, Stalin, he did believe in the communist ideology to a certain extent, so long as it didn't challenge him. And so what happened was, he kind of had this idea. He wanted communism, or someone gave him the idea that the communist principle could be applied to, like, plants growing. And if you're not sure how exactly that would work, neither did most agricultural scientists at the time. They didn't really get it. But there was, like, one guy who was saying, like, oh, yes, no, we can communism the farms. And once we communism the farms, why everything will be more productive, just like in all of communism. So they applied this kind of like bonkers outside theory. And anyone who tried to tell Stalin that this wasn't going to work would just get executed because it wasn't what Stalin wanted to hear. And sure enough, it caused a famine. And so the core thing behind this is that you realize that like dictators cause famines or other massive failures in their countries because they eliminate dissent. And this prevents people from telling them when they are about to cause a famine. Because everyone just tells Stalin, you know, everyone who wants to live is just like, oh yes, this is a good idea. So Padre was surrounded by people who didn't really speak up to him because whatever he did was a good idea, or otherwise he would kick them out of the band or punish them in some way. And that was kind of his character. He knew what the public wanted to hear, but he himself was not the man to actually carry out any of that stuff. Because he would have gone as far as like, okay, I'll do the vote, I'll do all this. But then as soon as something didn't go his way, he would have just altered the system unilaterally so that he would have gotten his way. And that was the dangerous thing about him that made him kind of the bad guy in the story. In the proper game that got played, what happened was the players, because they didn't really latch onto anything too firmly, they sort of just waited for stuff to happen, and the entire asteroid began to sort of tumble out of control. So you had Kinsey over on the other side, who was like this really weak... the counterbalance to Padre, who instead of having this very firm, like, well, it's my way or the highway, she kind of just trusted that the expertise of the asteroid would see it through and that she didn't personally have to exert much of anything on it. Like, experts had always made things work, and so experts would make things work in the purpose. Like, Padre is just a passing fad. These problems we're having right now, these are all temporary. The singers will come by next year and they'll fix everything because we've always trusted them and it's always been fine and everything like that. And because she was really not doing anything herself, and Padre was taking all these proactive steps to kind of rally the asteroid and get people together, he pretty much dominated. Like he smashed down her faction pretty well until she just had her hardcore supporters. And the rest of the asteroid didn't really try to stop him until he began advocating for, like, killing the singers, at which point that was too far of a departure from what everyone was used to. And then you got more people who, like, didn't really like Kinsey, but they joined with her because they didn't want to, like, kill the singers. So they got stuck in this situation where they had two possible choices, and it was either, like, this weird sort of autocrat that they could join in with, who was saying what they wanted to hear, or they could go with Kinsey, who was going to let things continue to sputter out of control, but was at least not going to kill the source of like food and trade that was coming into the asteroid. So everyone was in a bad position, and I was just curious to see how the players would kind of tackle it. But because they were just like, well, we'll just kind of wait and see how it evolves. All that happened was just the inevitable happened. They wound up in kind of an armed standoff in a civil war sort of situation. And then I'm pretty sure that one of the players went up and there was that phone call that was coming in. So I was like, so that's on the table. You guys could answer that, even though it's forbidden and it might just be a nuclear bomb. So I think one of the players was just like, well, it can't get any worse than this. And they went to go answer the phone. They didn't have to answer the phone, but that was what they did. And that's why that happened in Glam Rock. But that's pretty much the shape of it. It didn't go over very well. Again, the narrative format was kind of bad for it. And I knew I was in trouble when it came time to actually write the script for the game, as I was like, oh man, I have to do basically an entire episode of like exposition just to get everybody on the page of like, this is sort of the political, this is who you know, this is why you care. Because that's really ugly. I mean, that's like very boring, and you easily lose people that way. If you're not good at making that interesting. And I know some people said they really like Glam Rock, so it's not like I'm saying like, oh, well, it was really flawed and you're wrong for liking it. But for sure, I kind of had myself in a dangerous situation with trying to tell a story where I have to like explain who everybody is before we can even begin, before the players can make their characters and everything like that. So this is one reason why dungeon role-playing is much more popular than the sort of story-based thing that I like to do. Because a lot of times I would skit this all the time as I would play these games. And so sometimes we'd have a game pitch and it would sound good. And then we'd start to play it and it would be just really, it would turn out to be really flimsy for the format. So I'd be like, okay, this isn't going anywhere. And they would kind of like putter off and end. Because a lot of times you play these as campaigns rather than one shot. So you get together every week. And then a few weeks in, you start to just be like, I'm not really feeling this. I don't know where we're going. And so you just have to kill it right there and just be like, we'll do a new game. And so you'd have like a couple of misses. We probably had more misses when I was younger than hits. And this can be due to just a lot of different factors. But you know, I don't. Narrative role playing is a lot tougher. It's got more working parts. The players have to be decent at ad-libbing, improv, that type of thing. The GM has to be able to think up answers to stupid questions on the spot really well. Characters have to kind of like villains have to grab you really quick and everything like that. Yeah, I had a couple of people leave the Patreon recently, but not citing financial reasons, just said some other reason and then no details. And I'm not sure if that, because you can clearly see that there's some political inspiration, like some real world inspiration for some of the glam rock stuff, like the American struggle with our two-party system and the big voting fiasco that's gone on recently and everything like that. Pretty sure I can't hide that is involved, which makes some people angry. Some people just really, really do not like to hear about it. And it depends on the person exactly why they don't want to hear about it. We've had a couple. We used to have some guys on the server. One of them actually quit the Patreon a while back because he was posting his political opinions all the time. And people would argue with him because, you know, they weren't like good takes. They were just like things that he read on Twitter. And he would be like, I read this on Twitter and I'm mad. And then people would argue. And so then eventually he left and he's like, the community is too toxic. I can't handle these people or anything like that. So politics today, I know that'll drive people off. And it could be people could leave because they don't want to be reminded of the politics, or people could leave because they disagree with my politics or my perspective on the politics or everything. For what it's worth, I find politics today very frustrating, the state of them. I'm pretty sure I'm not alone on that regard. I don't know. I have quite a few thoughts, but I do feel that they were reflected into glam rock. One of the things I think that's going on right now that's a big problem is that we do have this kind of awkwardness where you have, like, on the right wing, you've got these people who we are calling populists, and they aren't really populists. Like, if you look at what the populists stood for back in the 1800s, like, the Populist Party was actually a real party in the United States, and they were a sort of like a farmer's party. They were like working class men that got together and they were trying to get rights for farmers, factory workers, that type of thing. Back in that time, they were still on the gold standard. And the way the gold standard works is it's kind of deflationary. So, right, you can only print as much money as you have gold, and that means that money is in scarcity. So as time goes on, you get more demand for money than there is supply, and the relative value of the money goes up. So if, like, today a hamburger costs you $5, tomorrow a hamburger costs you $2. And the banks really liked this because they would give you a loan and they'd say, like, okay, so you buy this farmland for like $500 or whatever. And so that was how much you owed. You couldn't get out of that. You were going to pay back $500. But then, like, next year, like, when you got the loan, $500 bought you 500 hamburgers. But then next year, $500 would have bought you like 200 hamburgers. They would have bought you 1,000 hamburgers or whatever. So the point is that you're basically like losing value as time goes on because the currency is deflationary. And this would just obliterate people. Like, farmers would lose their shirt and everything because they couldn't control the deflation. And so the populists were this huge march to like get rid of the gold standard. It was actually multiracial because there was a lot of minority groups that were stuck in the working class working for basically nothing. And they couldn't really like raise wages for the lower class without raising wages for everybody. Because if you allow people of the lower class, like if you're like, oh, well, that's okay, Mexicans and black people, they can earn, you know, less than white people. Well, then the companies will just go straight to those minorities and pay them the lower wages. And then that forces the white people to come down and work at those lower wages as well. So it screws everybody. And so they were actually kind of a multicultural movement until the Democrats started taking up some of their cause. And then the Democrats were still a little bit of a, they were the racist party at the time. And so they kind of took on some of the populist stuff, but then not the multiracial aspects. See, there's a problem in our two-party system, though, where if one party takes up your cause, then the other party kind of will oppose that cause. So once the populists kind of got the Democrats on board with certain parts of their cause, the Republicans just opposed it, and they kind of really didn't have any other choices. And losing that element did kind of undermine some of what they were trying to achieve. And then they lost some election stuff, and they wound up not getting everything that they wanted. And it took a long time before they really did get off the gold standard. But it was the gold standard was a big problem for the average person for a very long time. So at any rate, though, that was kind of the beginning of the Democrats as like the People's Party, though. And they kind of continued on until then, until they got to Roosevelt, who FDR, who did the New Deal stuff and got a lot of things for the average person that people really kind of needed. And then in the 70s, the Democrats kind of flipped their tune and they changed their primary system and they started to kind of walk away from the populace. And then the Republicans started to adopt that rhetoric. So they got on the other side, but the Republicans never really stopped supporting who they were supporting. So Republicans today, they're still really kind of all about wealthy tycoons and rich men and the elites and everything like that. But when they get up on their pulpit, they talk about like, oh, well, the working class and these people need everything like that. And they're right. Like, the working class has really suffered in America, and they really do need to be respected more than they have been. Like, that anger that people are feeling in this country today about how things have turned out. Like, you had these industry towns where people were all employed, and then they just shipped all those jobs to China. Not because the labor is cheaper, actually. I mean, you hear that excuse a lot, but the real reason is because China pollutes. They let these companies just make products any way they want. And so, like, people, like, workers are sort of a fixed cost. So if you have a factory with 1,000 people, you know, you pay those wages and that's a fixed cost. But if you want to pump out, like, 1,000 more widgets or whatever, well, your process is going to alter how much that'll cost. So like if you have like a really dirty process and you just dump all the waste in the ocean, then the cost per widget goes way down and you can sell your product for way cheaper. Whereas like if you kept everything in the United States, you had to follow certain regulations and meet certain standards, and then your cost per widget would go up. And this whole thing, it's all really complicated politics. So if you kind of look into that, you get into, they were having some issues with stagflation and moving stuff over into China to make goods cheaper actually helped eliminate some of that stagflation. So it's not like it was all just this kind of intentional poisoning of the nation. But ultimately, though, it hollowed out the Rust Belt and everywhere else. Like, all those ordinary people lost their jobs, and they really had nowhere to go, and there's no safety net or anything like that. And then the Republicans come in, and they talk about, like, well, you know, those elitists in their college ivory towers talk about how we need some social systems, and who are they to tell you how to live? And people really get into that because they really don't like the system. You know, it's like, oh, who are those elitists to tell us how to live? But the Republicans are the only ones using that rhetoric, whereas the Democrats are kind of like, well, we all need to listen to the experts and form the consensus and everything like that. And the problem is that when you have consensus, there's a sort of orthodoxy. And so, like, who's paying the experts? Like, well, industry is paying the experts. So when they talk about, like, how should we solve healthcare? Well, they turned to the healthcare companies to help them solve healthcare. And the healthcare companies were like, well, we should do this in a way that doesn't hurt healthcare profits. So we got Obamacare, which you can argue did some things to help people, but ultimately did not solve the healthcare problem. It still costs a fortune to get healthcare treatment. Like, whatever side of politics you're on, the basic facts of life in this country are still really the same. you know, a few small things change, and you can talk about like, oh, it's great, we had those baby steps. But the harder things are getting for people, the more that baby steps are not enough. And so this perspective that I have on politics are kind of where it's sort of what informed the glam rock conflict that then, of course, didn't translate very well into the game. But that's the idea, is like, so Kinsey kind of represents the modern sort of liberal perspective of like, well, we just need to keep waiting for the experts to figure out who to blame, because it's not the experts that are causing the problem. It's, you know, clearly circumstances beyond our control are causing the issue, and the expertise is perfect. It's fine. It's working. We just need to wait. And then you have Padre, who's just like, oh no, it's not working and there needs to be change. But the change is that I will take over and then destroy everyone who tells me what's going wrong. And then, of course, Padre would cause a big famine and a bunch of problems and everything else like that. Padre is probably worse, but he's faster. You get through his pandemonium most of the time a lot faster. Of course, there are some countries that you look at that have had that kind of autocracy for a very long time. So whoever really knows with these types of things. But anyway, though, that was kind of what I was trying to hammer at, and I don't know. It's all like nuance. There's a lot of perspective that could go into it, and all you really get is like, what does Mason think? What does Lowry think? What is Paul saying? And what does Elvis think? And then, of course, Elvis is like this rock star. He's doing a lot of drugs. And Lowry is kind of like a womanizer. He's not that focused on the politics. And you have Mason, who's playing like my point with Mason, what I was trying to get with Mason was that he was more of an everyman. The idea was like, Mason was not really more skilled or more knowledgeable than anyone. Like, yeah, he read his books and he thought his books made him really smart. And while he was trying to use his books to like fix the asteroid with some kind of, like it was just something like, oh, I read about democracy. I know how to fix democracy and whatever. As he was doing that, he was failing. But when he finally just said like, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to trust the asteroid to work for itself, to give itself the improvements that it needs, that's sort of when he achieves some triumph. And because he's no longer just trying to like impose a high-minded framework on the whole thing. It's finally just like, okay, so the people probably know what they want, and we'll let them do this. And it wouldn't be a perfect system, which is why it doesn't end with like, they fixed everything and everything's good. It's just how it is. The singer, the robots that come in and kill the singers, they're not, when I set up the game, it didn't really matter what would have happened. Like the singers that come in to take the tithes, like they'd been doing this year after year after year, and they considered it largely a civilian concern. So they never really showed up with very many weapons. It was mostly just like it was like truckers, basically, like space truckers. It's just that they didn't seem that way because they were a far advanced alien species. So just like a bunch of civilian truckers that would show up. And if the colonists had decided to kill all of them, then they would have been completely blindsided by it and then killed. And then like the broader Singer government would have looked at that and would have been like, well, according to our records, this asteroid's like hollowed out and empty. There's like nothing of value there, right? So why even waste the money to shoot a missile at it? So they would have gotten away with that. That was like hidden information, though. There was no way for anyone to know that, let alone viewers. Which again, like if I'd written a book about this and you get this like third person omniscience where I could like maybe cut to the perspective of the singers and have them like looking at their quotas and being like, I don't know, the asteroid's spent. It's like, well, what should we do about that? Like, what do you think we should do? And they'd be talking about it. So you'd have even more tension where maybe like the singers would be doing something. You'd get insight on what they think, and then like what is driving Padre, what is driving Kinsey, and not having it be all constrained to just like Mason's point of view, which is intentionally somewhat ignorant, because the point I was trying to make is that leadership in any setting is not superhuman. The people who are in charge of things today, a lot of them don't strike me as even being very smart. Like if you look at the types of things that certain politicians say, I mean like, okay, if you're on the left, you can see lots of people on the right wing who you know are just not very smart people. And if you're on the right wing, I know you got your punching bags on the left who you're looking at and you're saying those are some of the dumbest people in the world, right? Well, the truth is that lots of people in those leadership positions, or even with like degrees or expertise or whatever, they might have been good students, and maybe they had enough money to be elected, or they ran unopposed, or whatever. But that doesn't mean necessarily that they're like naturally gifted to hold those positions. It's not something like they just got those because they're better than everybody. A lot of them are really, they're really dumb, flawed people. And it could be you. Could be me. You know, like, you gotta have a message that would carry you, and you gotta get the funding and everything else like that. But man, like, anybody could be one of those politicians given the right circumstances. If maybe the area were competitive enough, or if you could get in on the primary and just take over. Like, the fact that maybe you don't have a college education, you may not be worse off than the guy who's currently sitting in office. You might actually have a better head on your shoulders than some of the guys that are there. I hear about some of the local politicians are allegedly, some of them are allegedly like drunks and not even really like entirely focused on things that matter. So that was the point. Like, it was like Mason wasn't the right guy, but no one really is. You just need to have faith in the people, because the entire point of a government is for the people. Like, you just don't have a nation without the people, right? And that's the framework behind every democracy or republic. It's every kind of like egalitarian government system takes that approach, is where you look and you say the people are the country. Like, that is the whole point we have any of this. Like, that's why we collect the taxes, that's why we do the government, that's why we do the voting, that's why we do anything. Is because if we were a nation of just like the congressmen and just the senators, it would be like smaller than a micronation. It would barely qualify as a city state. It'd be like a little town of rich people who are just like deciding how they wanted to, what did they want to do today, passing laws that meant nothing. Cause it all comes back to the general populace. That's what it's really all about. So, yes, that's glam rock. It was overly ambitious and was not cut out for the format that I told it in. Should have been like a book or something. And then you would have gotten a lot more perspective and a lot more background. And have been like, this is going on. Heck, I could have made a joke about a lizard. We could have cut to the perspective of one of the lizards that I mentioned and then almost never brought up again and be like, what are the lizards thinking? And you could even get that little bit of flavor. So all that stuff, like the musical background, the rock and roll sort of stuff and everything like that, would have been a lot better explored in a third person format than the second person format. The other thing too is that, like, we talk about like, oh, the platforms are controlled by music and we're going to battle things with the bands. It's like a literal battle of the bands. Well, because it was all on an asteroid, it's sort of like any kind of explosive device you fire down a hallway is going to be pretty lethal. So every fight would have been over really fast. There was a lot at stake and a lot to be worried about. So the more practical thing was to talk it out and to not actually shoot at each other. And this is a little bit of a problem with having a very enclosed setting. There's actually a lot of sci-fi movies. There was a whole rash of them for a while, and it was always like trapped in a space station film. I think because Aliens did so well. And what made Aliens work was not that they were being chased by some powerful alien in a space station. It's that they like secured one objective and then they had to get to the other side of the space station. And all along the way, they're running into all these different obstacles. So like one area is flooded, and then over here, there's this problem they've got to go up. They got to like climb up this way, but the aliens are faster climbers than them. So they've got to figure out how to like, oh God, how do we climb? Like, oh, they're coming. Oh no. So all the tension is actually them overcoming the obstacles of the scenery and not just like running from a slasher villain or whatever. So with a game, you kind of have that same problem where if it's like a very enclosed space, you're either going to do a classic D&D dungeon crawl where you're just walking room to room and killing everything in it because it has nowhere to go. Like, you're just going to go in there and bomb that stuff. Or you would have to set it up as a more of an alien style thing where you'd be like, okay, the party is here. And then every single room is going to be some sort of unique challenge and they have to figure out how to get through it. And I've got these very dangerous aliens they can't kill that are coming up behind them. So if they dawdle and they don't take action fast enough, then I kill a character, you know? And so that's also the classic, sort of a, one of the Cthulhu formats you can take if you wanted to do that, because that's like, oh, the horror is coming. We have to keep going. We have to get out of this house as it's collapsing or whatever. being sucked into the void or something like that. And it's also kind of the approach, like a lot of the older style D&D type of games revolve around that, where there's like puzzles in every room or traps in every room and you have to continue to advance. But those tend to be different in that a lot of times there's nothing chasing you. So you get the hilarious situation where like every party's best friend is the 10-foot pole, which they bring in, they touch it on every tile, like meticulously to make sure that none of the tiles are pressure plates. And if one of them is a pressure plate, you know, it sets off the poison arrows and they're like, oh, don't touch that one. So like given infinite amounts of time, players will just patiently make sure that they don't set off any traps. You have to start doing really stupid things to catch them. Best thing you can do is put a monster behind them that's chasing them. I did that once using the hero system, but all the characters, they had like teleporters. It was a 40K game. And so they like walked into a facility and like this giant robot powers up. It was like the security system, but it had gone haywire. I called it the Totatrua Sloth. And it was like one of the characters was AdMech. And so I was like gushing about it. Like, oh yes, the Totatrua Sloth, such rare technology. They will walk up to a target and then just rip it to shreds. Oh, there's nothing you can do once it grabs you. It's amazing. The only problem is they're so slow. And so that was kind of the joke, but they all had teleporters. So they just like teleported to another safe room because they also had a map. So they were just like, well, let's just teleport here. This looks like where we're going. So they just like teleported straight there. And I was like, crisis averted. Congratulations. But that was a game where I designed all the challenges without really paying attention to what they did with the characters. There was a lot of stuff for them to do. They had like so much to slog through. They skipped like two of the challenges in that game, but it didn't matter because there was another, like there was like a dozen things they had to get through anyway. So it's okay to have that one or two thing not work out. But anyway, though, that's that. I hoped you guys enjoyed this rant at my own writing process and what I personally didn't like about my own content. I had someone on there who was like, I wish that someone else would speak up and say, anything really, just more. He just wanted to see more comments so that he could... I don't know exactly. He didn't know exactly either, but whatever the case. This is my perspective. I tend to be critical of all the things that I do. And, you know, it's like once you do something, it's always much easier to tear it apart in hindsight. So in hindsight, a lot went wrong with the game. And there was a lot with the format that didn't really work for the podcast either. And it could have worked, but it really would have been much better off. It was a third person perspective kind of story. And I told it in the second person perspective. So, yes, everybody have a wonderful day, and I will catch you next time.